potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, we are going to be talking about big summer movies, because regardless of what the calendar says, and regardless of the fact that the kids are still in school, it's officially summer, according to Hollywood. Summer starts in May, and we actually got a jump on summer early in April with the Winter Soldier. But summer is officially here with the movie season, and we got the big one this week is, of course, Godzilla returning to the American movie screens after the 1998 pseudo-disaster, which we'll talk a little bit about that when I review the film later in the show. Also, we've got Million Dollar Arm, another inspirational Disney sports movie. We got some limited release stuff. We've got Only Lovers Left Alive, a new Jim Jarmusch movie, and then Jodorowsky's Dune, which is currently in limited release, and there's actually a reason I wanted to talk about that this week. We also have news and Trailer Park and listener feedback. We got one of those, and we got some box office predictions and the DVD roundup. But before we head into that, let's talk about how to get a hold of me. You can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail. That's 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. If you want to find me on the internet, you've got me at fatguysatthemovies.com or on facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. If you want to reach out to me personally on Twitter, you can go to twitter.com/KevinCarr. I'm usually there doing stuff, saying nonsensical things and tweeting them out into the world at large. That is how I roll.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
And that's how Ron Burgundy rolls. We're moving into the news section. The first piece of news is a sad piece of news. This person is sort of a legend in science fiction and horror cinema and art, in the art world in general, H.R. Giger, who is most famous for creating the alien and the look of the alien ship and the look of the space jockey and the look of the alien world in Ridley Scott's Alien. He was also instrumental in starting to design Dune, which we're going to talk about that when we talk about Jodorowsky's Dune, which is the connection for that one. He was in his 70s, and he had apparently suffered injuries falling down the stairs, and that's what eventually he died from, which is a really sad thing, and a thing to recognize. Sometimes something as mundane as falling down the stairs can be devastating to you, especially if you're in your 70s. So it's sad to see H.R. Giger go. This guy was dark and twisted in his art, but wow, was he a visionary. And the science fiction world has never been the same since he started doing design work. So he's a significant part of cinema history, and you see his designs creeping into everything from Batman to even like Star Wars, and that the designs that come from that, anything dark and twisted and weirdly sexual oftentimes has roots in H.R. Giger's work. So he will be missed, and his designs and art is going to be missed. The next piece of news we have is a piece. This is the best piece of news of the week, and the reason it's the best piece of news is because it bumped the news of Beyonce's sister, Sonaj. Who names their kid that, by the way? That, I think, was the most shocking thing of that story, was that somebody actually named a child Sonaj or whatever her name is. But she beat down Jay-Z, and this is the piece of news that usurped that in the press. And that was the reveal of not just the new Batmobile for the Man of Steel sequel, Superman versus Batman, but it also revealed the Batsuit and Ben Affleck in his first pose in the Batsuit. And it was taken someone of as a candid photo. The Batmobile itself looks cool, but it looks really similar to the Tumbler from the Dark Knight trilogy. It's a Batmobile. It's a black car that looks cool, but it's not as sporty. It's more of a utility vehicle like the Tumbler was. The Batsuit, I'm fine with the Batsuit. There are people who are going bonkers about the Batsuit, but I think it looks really cool. He's got the short ears, which isn't just an Adam West throwback. That happens. You have those, like, I think it was Breyfogle who was drawing the short ears on the Batsuit back in the 80s, and it's all gray. It's all dark gray, so I think there are some people who are worried about the color scheme, and they wanted it blue and black, but you know what? Who cares? And he looks very sad at it. I mean, Batman is just kind of like, oh, kind of leaning over. But I think people forget that's the exact same pose that was in the Batman Begins poster. If you go and look that up, exact same pose, Batman sort of bending over, looking sad, brooding. I don't know. It so far it looks fine, but it's a single photo, so there's not a whole lot you can do with it. Another piece of news that is out this week, Robert Orci, who is famous for being the Orci Kurtzman writing producing team, and he wrote everything from Star Trek to, I believe they worked on Prometheus. He is going to be directing Star Trek 3. Now, the people on the internet who follow this stuff are, again, going bonkers over this because he has no directing experience. And people are saying, why are you handing this massive franchise for a movie that's probably going to be $150 million or more to somebody who has zero experience? And I can tell you exactly why. This is so Paramount can control him. Now, Orci may not have directing experience, but he has plenty of production experience. He's been a producer and a writer on some of the biggest movies we've had in the last 15 years. So he's not a stranger to the big budget movie scene. He may not be the directing veteran that even J.J. Abrams is, or you know, got Steven Spielberg, but they can control him. You're not going to have any of this mystery box nonsense that weighted down Star Trek Into Darkness. And I just watched that this past week again. And I can honestly say, a year removed from the whole thing, not having to worry about the mystery box, was it Khan, was it not Khan, who's the villain, aside from some really goofy stuff that happens near the end, it actually works better without that. And I think Paramount wanted to work with a director who they can control, who they can say, no, you don't need to put this misplaced fan service in there. We're just going to make a Star Trek movie and make it more, because they controlled Abrams with the first film. But when he got to the second film, he started playing around. So I think Robert Orci might be a good thing for Star Trek 3. We need to move on. That sound means that we're moving into the trailer park. Two movies I want to hit on really quickly. We've got one from Disney, which is Alexander and the Terrible, Horrible, No Good, Very Bad Day. It opens on October 10th. Stars Steve Carell and Jennifer Garner. And it's an adaptation of a picture book, like many picture books being adapted for the screen. There's a lot more going into the story to make it an hour and a half movie. Anyway, here's the trailer.
I can't believe Elliot Tixon photoshopped pictures of me to the whole school.
Nice boobs, Alexander.
My black book!
Unbelievable.
This day is so cursed.
You're not passing the blame on this one.
It was her fault.
I don't feel bad. I won't hurt anyone. Okay, stop!
I think that you just gotta have the bad days so you can love the good days even more. Trust me, I would know.
We are not going to let this day get the better of us.
This looks like it could be funny. It could be a fun family film. Again, because if you read the original book is a beautifully written picture book that is very simple and very directed and very much something that connects to a child who's like 8 or 9, because it's all about them and all about how things are weighting them down. And they look like they're expanding it greatly for this movie to, of course, take advantage of Steve Carell, because you don't want him playing an 8-year-old. Although maybe you, I don't know. No, I'm not saying that we should have Steve Carell playing an 8-year-old. I that would be a terrible idea. Return of Clifford with Martin Short. So I don't know. This one looks like it's going to be fine as long as you're not expecting it to be the book, because the book's quite different. There's also Snowpiercer, which opens on June 27th, and it made a lot of news because the Weinsteins demanded cuts to release it, and this is what we're getting.
On this train of life, I belong to the front. You belong to the tail. Know your place. Keep your place.
Precisely 74% of you shall die.
This is going to be good.
I have to say, this is the first time I've really seen anything about this movie beyond the story of it being cut by this Korean director who has a much larger international version. I don't know. The movie looks interesting. It looks out there and bizarre. I'm very excited to see it. I'm curious to see what they do. It's a bizarre looking film, but it looks like it's going to have some teeth to it. So I'm actually really looking forward to Snowpiercer. That opens June 27th. Anyways, we need to go to a break, and when we come back, I'm going to be talking about specifically Jodorowsky's Dune and how H.R. Giger fits in, and also Only Lovers Left Alive.
We'll be right back.
Kevin Carr with Fat Guys of the Movies moving at you. Fat Man is in his fat suit driving his Fatmobile. This is how I identify with Batman. I want pictures of me looking sad on the internet, and everybody can talk about the lack of color in my clothing. Maybe if I could just get Zack Snyder to tweet out a picture of me, people would take notice of my incredible physique. Anyways, speaking of nothing that's related to anything at all with this next film, the movie we're going to be talking about here is Jodorowsky's Dune. Now, in this segment, I'm going to be talking about some independent films, some smaller films that are in limited release. These are films that are worth checking out, worth finding, and whether or not you know the director or know the work, it's always neat to find an alternative to something. And, you know, these aren't mainstream movies. These are not movies that are going to be going out toe-to-toe with Godzilla. These are movies that are making, if they're lucky, a million or a couple million in the theaters. But they're a greater view of cinema. And I think these are important to look at. And like I said, the first one's Jodorowsky's Dune. Before David Lynch made his film in the 80s, Chilean director Alejandro Jodorowsky assembled a brilliant crew to adapt Dune into a film.
I wanted to make something sacred to change the young mind of all the world. Michel Sidoux said to me, I want to make a new picture with you. What do you want to do? I say, Dune. And he said, yes. I didn't read Dune, but I have a friend who said it was fantastic.
His vision was so huge, so beyond what anybody else was doing at that time. Things that George Lucas wasn't even going to try with Star Wars. It's enormous.
Part of Hodder's genius was finding the right people.
First, I want to preface this by saying I'm a huge, huge fan of David Lynch's Dune. I know there's not a lot of them out there. Dune is this book. If you've never read the book, it came out in the 60s, and it was this bizarre, very high-concept science fiction piece that was very well received in literary communities, very well read in the 60s, very much a sign of the time because it involved this psychotropic substance that controlled space travel in the world. And they'd been trying to adapt this thing for years. And different people held the rights to it. And eventually, at one point, they attached this guy, Alejandro Jodorowsky, who I'm not familiar with his work. He did a bunch of very weirdly independent films in the 60s and 70s, and they were out there. And he got the rights to do it because even though it was a huge piece, it was one of those books that was considered unfilmable. They said, well, it was just too big and too complex. And so much happens with the inner monologues of people. And he started to work on it. Eventually it imploded. It didn't come to fruition. And their rights kind of flopped around and ended up in the hands of Dina De Laurentiis, who tapped David Lynch, who did movies like at the time he had done Elephant Man, and he did Blue Velvet. He ended up doing Blue Velvet later, and he did Twin Peaks. But this guy was known for Eraserhead, these bizarre films. And David Lynch was also originally asked to do Return of the Jedi. He never did Return of the Jedi, which would have been a bizarre movie in its own. Could you imagine the Ewoks with an Eraserhead spin to him? Dune became this big $42 million movie, which was huge back in the mid-80s. That was an unheard of number. To put it in perspective, that was like 50% more expensive than it cost to do Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom that also came out that year. Dune was a bust because it didn't become the next Star Wars, but it wasn't going to because it was so high concept and bizarre and weird. And even though I thought it was a fantastic movie and very cinematic and very visionary, and I think if 30 years from now, people are going to be looking back and saying, yeah, Dune was a masterpiece. But right now, there's still a lot of bad blood to it. Jodorowsky assembled this amazing group of talent for it where he got Dan O'Bannon, who wrote the Alien script, to help him write it. He was going to get Salvador Dali to play the emperor, and he was going to pay him this exorbitant amount of hourly rate. And he got H.R. Giger to design the Harkonnen home world, which is where a lot of this very dark design first was put into play for a movie. It's an amazing film that could have been, but it never ended up becoming because there was that ultimate clash between budget and the business side of it and the artistic side. And so when you come to a studio and say, we need more money for this movie than you've ever put in any movie before, and it's going to be 10 hours long, you're going to have trouble selling that to the studio. And it shows the implosion of this project and what an impact it had on Jodorowsky. And while it was a fool's errand, it ultimately, and would have been a fascinating film, but could have never, if it was ever going to be made, it would have been made in the 70s, and it never was. So this is a movie that's worth seeing if you just want to see how sort of the internals of both inside and outside of Hollywood work. So ultimately, Jodorowsky's Dune kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys of the Movies with Kevin Carr. The next film I'm going to be talking about is Only Lovers Left Alive. Jim Jarmusch directs this tale about vampire lovers dealing with the fall of man in the modern age.
I had a dream about your sister.
Shouldn't she be sleeping in a coffin somewhere anyway? Probably with a wooden stake shoved in.
I'm really, really hungry. Do you maybe have something?
Could you smell it all the way from LA?
It's always a bit weird with family.
You're looking awfully pale there, Dr. Caligari.
Is that the really good stuff?
Precisely.
Now, in the world of Twilight and True Blood and Hemlock Grove and these supernatural romance movies that have sort of, romantic drama has co-opted and taken hostage horror elements like vampires, Jim Jarmusch actually gives a little bit back to the horror genre. Now, I mean, it's not a horror movie. I wouldn't call Only Lovers Left Alive a horror movie. It's more of a drama. But it takes it out of the weepy teen drama, which has been just getting its claws into vampires over the last 5-6 years. And ultimately, it's an interesting film. If you're familiar with Jim Jarmusch's work, if you've seen movies like Dead Man and Ghost Dog, The Way of the Samurai, and Stranger Than Paradise. These are movies that are way outside of the mainstream. He's sort of this icon of independent filmmaking who surfaced in the 80s and throughout the 90s and into the 2000s. He always was doing movies, but he never at all was trying to do them for the mainstream world. And he's played around in different genres. Dead Man was a Western. Ghost Dog, Way of the Samurai was ultimately a samurai movie starring Forest Whitaker, which is it's almost a comedic concept when you think about it, but it's not a comedy. This is his version of a horror film. And it's very dark and very moody. And it reminds me more of the morose emotional angst that you felt in the Anne Rice books and the Anne Rice movies, as even though some of the later movies like Queen of the Damned, and then they did a Vampire Lestat movie, which both of those are kind of crappy compared to the Interview with the Vampire that came out in the 90s. But it feels more like that. These somewhat humorless vampires, but an interesting take on how vampires would react to the modern world, where humans have, let's just say, they haven't taken care of themselves enough. And so they ultimately have a overall tainted blood supply, and it becomes dangerous for the vampires to actually feed on them. So they're sort of becoming the endangered species accidentally. And it gives that dark outsider's look to it. And not a whole lot happens in it. It's much more of a character study. But like I said, if you're looking for an alternative, especially an alternative to Twilight, you can check out Only Lovers Left Alive. It kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
With that, I need to go to a break. When we come back, I'm going to be talking about the big movies of the weekend, Million Dollar Arm and Godzilla. Here with Fat Guys in the Movies. We are going into the review segment for the big, huge blockbuster movies, the tentpoles, the tentpole. You've got Godzilla as a tentpole. Million Dollar Arm is the counter programming, and this one is by Disney, and it stars John Hamm as a struggling sports agent concocting a contest to find the first major league ball player to come out of India.
Guess what? We're out of money. I mean, I don't know what else to do, JB.
Hey, how fast are they pitching cricket? I think I cracked this.
Shaka-laka-boom.
Let's go
called Million Dollar R. We find the first Major League Baseball player from India.
Like being on the road?
Words cannot express.
Ray, how are you going to know if anyone can throw if you keep your eyes shut all day?
I can hear it.
Really?
Bingo.
We have our finalists.
Now, I'm not a huge baseball fan. I'm also not a huge sports fan. Anyone who knows me enough knows that. If you heard me talk about draft day a couple weeks ago, and I talked about how I kind of understand the basic ins and outs, but I'm not, I do not live and breathe sports at all. This is an interesting film because even though it's about sports, it's about baseball, but it's not about baseball. Why? Because there's no baseball played in this movie. It's sort of like Moneyball. If you remember Moneyball, there was no baseball that was played in Moneyball. I mean, it wasn't like 42 with Jackie Robinson. That one had a lot of stuff happening on the field. This one has almost nothing happening on the field because it's basically a tryout movie, but it exists in the sports world. And Disney has this long history of doing inspirational sports movies with Invincible and Remember the Titans and Miracle. They go to all the different sports for this. And this kind of is cut from the same cloth. It's inspirational. It's PG. It's something that the whole family can enjoy. You can take the kids and you don't have to worry about anything too scary or violent or sexual. It's pretty squeaky clean. Hollywood has recently realized that India is a huge country of people with a voracious appetite for movies. And Hollywood has been trying to exploit that for the last 10 years. And which is good, because I mean, it's giving, it's exploiting the marketplace, but it's playing to a certain demographic that up until, like I said, 10 years ago, the American film makers really weren't paying attention to. So, but this does have a certain number of Indian stereotypes. It also has some pretty heavy American stereotypes too with John Hamm in there. But ultimately, you know, it runs a good 2 hours, but it doesn't feel overly long. It's inspirational. It's more about chasing your dream and following your dream and doing the best you can to achieve that dream. It pushes buttons all throughout, and that's okay because that's what you'd expect for a movie like this. It's very charming. It's not going to win any awards, but it's a sweet, heartfelt movie that I quite enjoyed. I took my son, who's 10. He really enjoyed that movie, and it worked for both of us. John Hamm is good in it. I'd like to see him get a little more work outside of Mad Men. You have Lake Bell, who plays sort of the love interest in there. She's pretty good. It's a good cast. It's worth checking out. If you at all like inspirational movies that involve sports, you should enjoy this one. So I'm going to say Million Dollar Arm kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys in the Movies with Kevin Carr. Next up, we are talking about the big one, the big G. The giant lizard, Godzilla, is back on the movie screens. The last time we saw him in American cinema was in 1998 when Roland Emmerich did his version. And that's a much maligned version. I'm not defending it. Trust, this is not a good movie, the 1998 Godzilla. It's not completely not entertaining. I had a lot of fun watching Godzilla. And especially back in the day, the giant dinosaur effects were really cool. They're a little bit rudimentary now and a little bit cheaper, and they look like they were made in the 90s. But I kind of have a soft spot for Roland Emmerich's Godzilla, as terrible as it is at times, and as stupid as it was to put Matthew Broderick as them. Because, you know, when you say 90s action hero, you think Matthew Broderick. It took them 16 years to do this. Now, they've been making Godzilla movies in Japan for the last, 60 years? Pretty much nonstop. And there's this impression that people think that, oh, they just made Godzilla movies in the 60s and 70s, the stuff you saw on Mystery Science Theater. But they've been making these movies in Japan all the time. In the 90s, they have movies. In the 2000s, they had movies. And some of these recent ones are really pretty good that Toho made. They've done other Gamera movies as well. So these are things that, if you know anything about Godzilla, Godzilla has not been gone for 16 years. He's just been gone from American screens. Now they're doing the big budget, $160 million version of it. And we now have Godzilla directed by Gareth Edwards. After being awakened by atomic radiation, the ancient monster Godzilla goes on the warpath to destroy other monsters that threaten to take over the world.
In 1954, we awakened something.
There's nuclear tests in the Pacific. Not tests.
They were trying to kill it.
You have no idea what's coming.
Can you kill it?
Now, when it comes to a Godzilla movie, I've seen quite a few of them, and a lot of them are the real corny ones from the 70s, the goofy, really silly, obvious man in the rubber suit movies. But there's a lot of love I have for Godzilla, and one of the things I expect out of every Godzilla movie is that there's going to be several big SmackDown moments. There's going to be Godzilla wrecking cities, or you're going to have Godzilla fighting another kaiju monster. That's what I expect from a movie. You don't expect great characterization. And this one doesn't have great characterization of the human side. The problem is, as cool as it looks, and as amazing as the Godzilla action is when it actually happens, there's way too much focus on the human characters. And the human characters aren't terribly interesting, especially the ones that are told through the whole movie. Everyone's pushing Bryan Cranston as, oh, this is the guy starring in Godzilla. And he's in there, but he's a supporting character at best. And Elizabeth Olsen is in there, but she doesn't do much. She's a great actress. This is almost completely and squarely on the shoulders of Aaron Taylor Johnson, who's not that good of an actor. He's done Kick-Ass and he's done The Savages. But honestly, I really don't think this guy has much personality, especially when he's trying to do an American accent, because the guy's British. And his character's sort of, the reason you don't see these movies for the characters, you see the movie for Godzilla. And so you've got Godzilla and you've got these kaiju insect-like creatures called Mudos. And they look fantastic. And when they're on screen, they're really cool. The problem is, Gareth Edwards is drawing too much from his original movie Monsters that came out about 4 years ago. And in that movie, it was about people going through an area attacked by monsters. But since he had a low budget, most of the monster stuff, they had a little bit at the beginning, a little bit at the end. The rest of it was walking through the devastation. And that worked for an independent small movie, and it was innovative and different. But when you got $160 million at your disposal, you don't need to shy away from the monster scenes. Maybe I was spoiled by Pacific Rim last year, which I loved. And that movie had 4 or 5 massive monster beatdowns, and they were awesome, each one better than the next. This one has one. No, let me rephrase that. This one has several, but it only has one that goes complete. And they have these points where the monsters come together and they're getting ready to attack, and then they'll cut away to the human characters. And there's actually one scene where they're getting ready to do a big smackdown and they cut away, and then they have somebody watching the news in the corner of the screen. You can kind of see this TV and you're watching the battle on the TV and you're like, that would have been neat to see on the big IMAX screen, but you don't get to see it until the very end. And then it's sort of like almost too little too late. There's literally a scene where the monsters are coming at each other and they're getting ready to crash into each other, and they close these blast doors so you don't see anything. And then they cut to devastation later. And my point being is, I like a little more Godzilla in my Godzilla movies. I mean, this would be like in Braveheart, having the Scots coming down the hill and you have the British coming at them. And you remember that scene where they clash and they have like 5 minutes of carnage. Imagine if you had the Scots coming down and the British coming and they get ready to clash, and then somebody puts a cloak over their head and runs away. And then they come to the devastation and they find all the dead bodies later. That's what you get a lot of in Godzilla. So it's kind of this missed opportunity. Yes, when Godzilla's on screen, amazing. And probably some of the best effects work you're going to see this summer. But it's not enough. To me, it's a big disappointment from the Godzilla front. It's still a good movie, still worth seeing. Go see it in IMAX. It looks cool. But don't expect wall-to-wall Godzilla, because you don't get that. Still, ultimately, Godzilla kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
With that, I need to go to a break. When we come back, we're going to be talking box office, DVDs, and some listener feedback. Kevin Carr still here from Fat Guys at the Movies. We're going to be talking about box office, and we got some listener feedback. We've got some DVDs to talk about a little bit later on. But first, I actually said last week that Neighbors was going to win the weekend. It did, only it made more. I said it was only going to make $42 million. And that was along the lines of what a lot of people were predicting. It made $49 million, which is pretty impressive, especially for the fact it was an R-rated comedy, and it was going out against Spider-Man 2 in its second weekend. It made 50% more than Spider-Man 2 did. The bigger story, yes, Neighbors did well. And it's, I think, the biggest R-rated opening before Memorial Day. So it's not The Hangover 2 or anything like that, but it's really good for an R-rated movie. It also had an interesting thing about crossing demographics, because while it had the men showing up to see Seth Rogen be himself, you actually had a larger percentage of the audience being women going to see, presumably, Zac Efron. And that shows that that guy's actually still a draw, which is kind of amazing because Hollywood has not been kind to the High School Musical alumni. So, yeah, Seth Rogen, he did well. Zac Efron did well. And Rose Byrne got a lot of good compliments for her. It was a well-received movie. So, yeah, $49 million, which is more than I predicted, for Neighbors is pretty awesome. Now, the smaller story is The Amazing Spider-Man is falling off fast. Now, it's doing very well overseas. But let's face it, I'm going to be real honest here, and my apologies to anybody overseas, but right now overseas is a growth market for giant action-y tentpole movies. There doesn't need to be a good story. There just needs to be a lot of cool action. And then Spider-Man 2 has plenty of cool action. It just does not have a lot of intellectual depth and well-written scripting going on. So it's going to do well overseas, but it's interesting. It may not make $200 million at all in the States. It might just squeak past that, which is hugely disappointing considering that Spider-Man 3, that was what, 7 years ago and had no 3D, made like $150 million its opening weekend. So that's not good. Mom's Night Out did okay. It only made $4.3 million, which is a win for the movie because it didn't cost much. I think part of the reason that it didn't reach the faith-based audience is because it doesn't say Mom's Night Out because we're Christians or something like that. It doesn't call it out in the title like God's Not Dead or Heaven Is For Real did. Dorothy's Return, The Legend of Oz, did pretty bad. $3.7 million, which is, less than Mom's Night Out. And I think that that had to do with the fact that it was a direct-to-video movie put on the big screen. And it still had its merits, but not a lot. This week, I think, obviously, the winner is going to be Godzilla. I think people are going to be predicting $100 million plus for this movie. I'm actually going to hedge my bets a little lower. I think $88 million. It's getting a lot of good reviews, but there's a lot of people pointing out exactly what I did, that this movie is not about Godzilla as much as it is about Aaron Taylor Johnson and his sort of bland character with an occasional kaiju fight thrown in and often cut away from. And I think while some people are responding very well to that, and when I saw it in the screening, it got cheers in the movie, and it has a great third act with some great action, I honestly don't think that this is going to have the longevity, because it's really not that good of a story, and when it comes to a big explosive movie, they tease almost too much and don't deliver enough. And if you look at Pacific Rim for last year, kaiju movies, even with the name Godzilla attached to them, aren't necessarily going to be the biggest hits of the summer. So I'm saying $88 million for Godzilla. Next up, we've got some listener feedback. This comes from Chris from Kansas City. And he writes, do you think that in an age where so many films have been made that originality is not the most important thing when it comes to making a movie? For example, The Conjuring, even as a lover of film, I recognize that the story was pretty well used, but the cinematography, acting, and overall direction is superb. I just felt like originality is obviously welcome, but not the most important thing anymore. Your thoughts? Well, Chris, here's the thing. Movies have never been original. That's the reality. There are occasionally movies that are different, but even a movie like Star Wars, which a lot of people heralded for its originality, there was also a lot of people that pointed out it's nothing but a Western. It's just set in space. And if you actually look at it, there's so many influence from Kurosawa to the Star Wars movies that it was arguably not terribly original because it draws a lot of story elements, not just from mythology, the Joseph Campbell book that talks about where there's only a handful of stories and every hero's journey follows one of them. It was drawing from The Hidden Fortress and other Kurosawa works. And there are movies that are original. Every now and then there's a movie that's completely original and outside of the box and something you never expect, like Being John Malkovich. That came out, about 15 years ago? That movie was bonkers. That movie made no sense, but was amazing. And it was so original and so bizarre and so different And it clicked with audiences, but it wasn't a huge moneymaker. The biggest moneymakers and the biggest ones that Hollywood want, that they're attracted to, it has nothing to do with originality. The reality is there is no originality in most movies. There's not a whole lot of originality in stories. And the ones that are truly original and different don't reach a wide audience. So no, originality is not the most important thing, and it never really has been. It's whether or not you can get butts in the seat. And that's what Hollywood cares about. Now, you can have an original way of presenting something. The horror genre is a great genre to look at for that, because it is constantly reinventing itself. They had the Asian-influenced horror in the early 2000s with The Ring and The Grudge. You had torture porn that showed up kind of in the mid-2000s. In the late 2000s, you had found footage, and none of these stories were really original stories. They were just a different way of presenting them. And every year you'll get big movies that might be like The Avengers, which you had never seen anything like that on movie screens, but not because the story was necessarily new. You just hadn't seen a 6-part movie that culminated in one giant action masterpiece. And same thing with Avatar, one of the highest grossing movie ever. Avatar is not a terribly original story. A lot of people said, hey, this is just Fern Gully with aliens. Same thing with Titanic. There's nothing original about Titanic. They did It Happens One Night shortly after the Titanic sunk. So the idea of, you know, the star-crossed lovers, the upstairs downstairs lovers, that's nothing new. That goes back, you know, forbidden love, that goes back to Romeo and Juliet. So all these stories are used in some way. And if you have a story that's not, it's not going to get a wide release. It's going to be so marginalized because it's so different and bizarre. Even something that's a fiercely independent movie that gets a lot of appreciation from the independent realm, something like Short Term 12, is not a movie you're necessarily going to see on the big screen. It released by Warner Brothers in a 3,000 theater run. It was released by Cinedigm, and it had a very small audience, very good movie, great performances, but again, it's not a terribly original movie. It's a very typical story about people dealing with the crap that life throws at you. So just because it's original does not mean it's good either. There's a lot of original movies out. I've seen some independent films that are original and out of the box, and they're terrible. So originality it's never been the name of the game. And that's not politically correct to say, but that's the truth. Hope that answers your question. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. And that sound means it is time to roll into the DVD Roundup. Spotlight this week. We actually talked about this a couple weeks ago when it came out, about a month and a half ago on Blu-ray. There are two movies I want to, well, one in particular, but they were two recently released movies on Blu-ray that I want to just kind of highlight because they're relevant. You've got King Kong versus Godzilla, which recently hit Blu-ray from Universal Pictures. And this is classic kaiju movie, and it crosses with the American audience for Godzilla, even though it has King Kong in a sort of a weirdly Japanese version of King Kong. But it's a lot of fun. These movies are great. It also came at the same time that King Kong Escapes, which is basically King Kong versus Mecha King Kong. Both of these movies are a lot of fun. So you can get these on Blu-ray now. The movies that are new this week, we've got Her, which stars Joaquin Phoenix as a guy who falls in love with his operating system. Like, that's never happened to anybody. And that's one of my favorite movies of last year. Definitely worth checking out. If you haven't seen it, get it, rent it, buy it. It's a great movie. There's also That Awkward Moment, starring Zac Efron, who failed to bring people into the audience for this movie. It's a rom-com told from the guy's point of view, which never tends to do well box office-wise, but it actually has a lot of heart. It's about these guys trying to find a relationship for each of themselves. Bob's Burgers, the complete third season. That's a funny, funny show from Fox's animation block. The Perry Mason Movie Collection, Volume 2. This is a set of Perry Mason TV movies from the late 80s. And they're formula and they're goofy, but they're the essence of TV movies from the late 80s. And they have some great guest stars like David Hasselhoff and Aaron Gray and Jerry Orbach. So I had great fond memories of watching crappy 80s television with my family when I was younger. So this sort of brings back memory. And then Generation Iron, which is a story of bodybuilders working to become the next Mr. Olympia Worth checking out. I ate chocolate chip cookies while I watched it, so I think I missed the point. The stinker of the week is I, Frankenstein, sort of a disaster of a film that has great origins, but just was not effectively done. This is not good. Next week, we're going to be talking about X-Men, Days of Future Past, Blended, Belle, and for Memorial Day, Hornet's Nest. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.